It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross swords with politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of smart stuff. We are away from the cosmos and know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are other suns. We have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome. Tis I, Dawn, your skeptical philosopher and political scientist. This week's Web Wisdom Edition starts off on the topic of extinction, as in, what really killed off the dinosaurs? You may be surprised. Let's listen in.
So you just clicked on this video, you saw the title, you probably think you already know the answer to this question. But as it often turns out, the science is more complicated than what we have been told. First, let's take a look at the story we've heard, and why we're so sure that an asteroid impact was a big part of the dinosaurs not existing anymore. I'm not gonna lie to you, it was a really bad day. Sometime around 66 million years ago, a giant asteroid about the size of Manhattan careened into Earth. It smashed into the ocean on the shores of what we now think of as the Gulf of Mexico and caused lasting damage to the planet. The energy of the impact itself vaporized every living thing within a day's walk, then huge chunks of the meteorite that had been thrown up into the atmosphere started raining back down as molten glass. The ensuing cloud of ash and dust that was vaulted into the atmosphere obscured the sun for decades, creating a dim, cold climate plagued by acid rain and firestorms. Over the millennia that followed, at least 50% of the species on Earth disappeared. 20% of the world's species of sharks, rays, and skates, nearly 60% of the plants, 98% of the warm water corals, and of course, 100%. Of the dinosaurs. For most of us, that collision has become a kind of shorthand explanation for why the dinosaurs disappeared. And because we associate asteroids with extinction, it's a scenario that still scares us. But as our knowledge expands, we've come to see that what killed the dinosaurs, like all of the other great extinctions that happened before, was probably a lot more complex than just a big rock falling into the ocean. Because it turns out, there was more than one disaster movie playing at the Cineplex that was Earth 66 million years ago. It was such a calamity that it literally, in geological terms, marked the end of an era. The dinosaur-dominated period of life that we knew as the Cretaceous era was suddenly over. The new normal, marked by the rise of mammals, would be called the Paleogene era. The giant die-off that created this transition is now known as the Cretaceous-Paleogene extinction event, or the KPG for short. And like many things in science, there's not a whole lot of consensus about what caused the KPG, but there are a few facts that everyone agrees on. First, about 66 million years ago, the climate changed a lot. All over the world. We can tell by changes in the types of marine fossils from both before and after the event, along with differences in soil chemistry and other evidence, that the climate became much cooler really fast, by 7 degrees Celsius in some places. The transition was so abrupt that the layer of rock that separates the before picture from the after picture is easy to spot with a well-trained eye. It's known as the Cretaceous-Paleogene boundary. And the chemistry of this boundary of rock is itself another weird clue, because it shows up all over the world in the same way, a sudden appearance of a layer of clay that's rich in iridium. Iridium is a metal, and if you've never heard of it, that's because it's very rare on Earth. We tend to find it most often in meteorites and other celestial deposits. The last clue that everyone agrees on is simply extinction itself. Tons of living things just disappear from the fossil record. Tyrannosaurus rex, the biggest land predator at the time, Benedettali is a group of tall plants with thick armored trunks, and a whole passel of reptiles that lived alongside the dinosaurs and are still sometimes mistaken for them. Aquatic reptiles like mosasaurs and plesiosaurs and pterosaurs, those freaky flying reptiles, all of them gone. So the reason that the asteroid impact theory is so compelling is that it explains pretty much all of those things. The theory first came about because of that iridium. In 1980, geologist Walter Alvarez was studying clay deposits in Italy that dated back about 65 million years and found that they contained hundreds of times more iridium than normal. And the more of that stratum of the Earth that he sampled in different parts of the world, the more iridium he found. Since iridium is rare on Earth but plentiful in space rocks, Alvarez and his father, Nobel Prize-winning physicist Luis Alvarez, has hypothesized that it was a sign of an enormous asteroid impact. Based on the amount of iridium they found, they figured that the collision was caused by a giant metallic rock about 10 kilometers across, big enough to create an impact with the energy of 180 million megatons of TNT. Clearly, it was a game changer. Alvarez and Sun theorized that this collision must have been what wiped out the dinosaurs. Soon, scientists started finding other signs of a colossal asteroid impact, like shocked quartz. At KPG boundary sites around the world, the quartz looked like it had been transformed, its crystals rearranged by tremendous pressure that you'd never suspect to find on Earth's surface. Then they found tektites, big teardrop-shaped pieces of glass that form when rocks are thrown into the atmosphere by an impact and then melt on re-entry. So all the signs pointed toward a huge, ugly collision. But there was one thing missing. A crater. Scientists knew about a lot of different impact craters around the world, but none of them matched the magnitude of the one that the Alvarezes envisioned. Then researchers started noticing that a lot of the evidence they were studying, the iridium, the quartz, the glass, was all concentrated in North America. So they focused their search using new technology like satellite imagery and scans that measure the density of rock beneath the surface. And in 1991, they found what they were looking for. A giant crater just off the coast of Mexico's Yucatan Peninsula, about 180 kilometers across. About the size you'd expect a 10-kilometer asteroid to make, and marked by huge disruption in the layers of rock about 66 million years ago. It was named after the nearby town of Chicxulub, and that is how the biggest piece of the puzzle came together. The asteroid impact theory, also known as the Alvarez hypothesis. So like I said, this theory checks off a lot of the boxes when it comes to the evidence we have. Explains the abundance of iridium in the rocks? Check. Accounts for the drastic and sudden change in climate? Check. Was capable of killing 50% of life on Earth? Double check. So the rest is history. By which I mean it became accepted as historical fact, and it's the quick and easy answer to the question of what killed the dinosaurs. Now, you're not going to find many scientists who say that there was never any impact or that the theory is totally off base, but there are many who think that there were other factors at work, and that the extinction might well have started before any asteroid came to finish the job. It turns out, for instance, that the impact occurred in the middle of the most severe volcanic activity Earth has ever seen. India is home to one of the largest lava flows in the world, with volcanic rock covering an area the size of France, and in some places, nearly 2.5 kilometers thick. These formations are known as the Deccan Traps, and they were formed by a series of mind-blowingly huge eruptions that scientists think began about 500,000 to a million years before the Yucatan impact, and kept going for hundreds of thousands of years afterward. Such violent, prolonged eruptions would have had an unmistakable effect on the climate, sending ash and dust into the atmosphere, obscuring sunlight, killing vegetation, and altering weather patterns around the world. And sure enough, fossils show changes in things like microscopic marine life that suggest a steep dive in temperature before the impact by as much as 5 to 8 degrees Celsius. Now, the big picture impacts of this kind of climate change, whether it was caused by volcanoes or an asteroid, are probably pretty obvious. But the thing is, we're not sure how exactly this led to the dinosaur wipeout. For instance, despite the fact that we think of dinosaurs as reptiles, they probably weren't cold-blooded. But from what we can tell about their physiology, they weren't warm-blooded like modern birds either. So they might have been somewhere in between, or different types of dinosaurs could have had different types of metabolisms, but in either case, they weren't able to adapt as well or as quickly to changing temperatures as mammals or other kinds of animals. Another problem dinosaurs likely suffered was simply their own success. They were by far the largest animals on land, and lots of fossil beds suggest that sometimes they lived in dense populations. So dinosaurs were probably competing with each other for food, water, and territory by the time the curtain started to fall. Throw in a tiny little variable like a 7-degree change in temperature, and you can see how things would fall apart pretty quickly. While some dinosaurs might have given in pretty quickly to the cold, the plant eaters may have dwindled more slowly as huge swaths of plant life started to disappear, and then, without any herbivores to prey on, the meat eaters began to vanish. But that's just one scenario. In addition to volcanoes exploding and space rocks hurtling toward us, it also seems that the oceans were disappearing, not because of changes in climate, but because of changes in the plates of the Earth's crust. Again, about 65 million years ago, the usually dynamic rifts where plates meet under the ocean floor began to stagnate. It's like the plates just stopped moving. And once they stopped, those rifts began to settle, sinking down into the Earth's mantle. As the seafloor dropped, ocean levels dropped with them. This phenomenon, known as marine regression, completely changed the map of the Earth. Inland seas, like the one that used to run through the middle of North America, disappeared, and more than 28 million square kilometers of land suddenly became exposed in less than 100,000 years. Marine regressions don't happen often. often, but when they do, they are usually linked to extinction events. Because not only do they remodel life on land, turning shorelines into plains and lakes into deserts, they also wreck everything for aquatic life. Marine regressions cause big changes in ocean depth and temperature and can create huge oxygen-poor dead zones. This is probably why fossils show enormous die-offs in plankton, for instance, tens of thousands of years before the Chicxulub impact. With these centers of the food web gone, it makes sense that other saltwater creatures like sharks and rays and corals and reptiles like mosasaurs and plesiosaurs would not be far behind. Again, it could have played out in a number of ways. And in a way, it's kind of fun to consider all the different scenarios. Like, if the Chicxulub impact had never happened, the world would be a very different place. We might still have a world with pterosaurs and armored trees and me riding a triceratops at the rodeo. I definitely wouldn't do that. Let's be honest. I don't even want to ride a horse. A tame, docile, old horse. I'm like, ow. No. But even if there were no asteroid, a lot of dinosaurs and marine life would probably be gone anyway. In that case, the Chicxulub impact may have just been the last nail in the coffin, something that turned an already really hard day into one of the worst days in the history of the planet. The point is, we still don't have one single answer to what caused the KPG extinction event, though we generally talk about it like we do. But the more clues we tease out of the ground, the better we'll be able to understand what could cause such a diverse group of animals that once ruled the Earth to all but disappear.
Well, that was interesting. On the topic of extinction, how many mass extinctions have there been? How close have we come to the end of all life on Earth? And are we currently experiencing a mass extinction event? Let's listen in and learn.
Hello there. I may look strange to you, but I like to be prepared at all times for whenever the next mass extinction might happen. But I do think it's important to impart this information in a non-muffled way, so I think I'm just gonna go ahead and take this off.
That would suck to have to wear that all the time. So you never know when the next mass extinction is going to happen. I mean, there have been 5 of them in the last 450 million years alone. And it's not like a mass extinction is some kind of blurry, ill-defined term. It's when at least 50% of the species on the planet go extinct. One of them, which has been aptly dubbed the Great Dying, wiped out more than 95% of the species on the planet. It's enough to make you walk around with a gas mask. It's possible that the gas mask is excessive. It's also possible that it's useless. I mean, if we get hit by a big meteor, probably not going to help that much. Mass extinction events happen pretty fast on a geological scale, but the actual, like, dying occurs on our scale quite slowly, tens of thousands of years. And of course, the most important thing to look at here is what these 5 giant mass extinction events had in common so that we can see them coming. Climate change, usually caused by changing CO2 levels and relatively rapid global temperature changes. Yeah, so you see where I'm going with this? I don't mean to alarm anyone here, but the idea that the Earth is currently, as I sit here, going through a 6th mass extinction event is actually not that crazy. Scientifically, it actually might make really good sense. Before we even look at climate change, we already know that humans have been a strange and mysterious and new force for mass extinction. Current extinction rates are somewhere between 100 and 1,000 times what they would be naturally due to humanity's very enterprising nature. And that rate is similar to, or even greater than, the rates of some mass extinction events of the past. So let's forget about all that depressing stuff for a moment and hop into the SciShow Time Machine. Our first stop, 450 million years in the past, and we're gonna get a little bit wet because pretty much all life on Earth at that time was in the oceans. Welcome, everyone, to the Ordovician-Siluvian mass extinction event. Now, you're not going to see any giant comets or meteors falling from the sky, but sometime in the next 10 million years or so, we're gonna see 2 really dramatic die-offs, both of them involving the influx of gigantic glaciers and dramatic worldwide falls in sea level. These 2 events will be separated by about 1 million years, now it's geologic time, remember people, and by the end of the second one, 27% of all marine families and 60% of all marine genera were extinct. And I can tell from your blank stares that we're going to require a little bit of a refresher on the biological classification system, which of course classifies all life based on common descent, and which we will be talking a lot about as we get more into extinction events. Starting with the most specific, and then getting to the most general, we have species, genus, family, order, class, phylum, kingdom, domain, and good old life. Back to the Ordovician event, what scientists think happened here was that Gondwana, one of the two supercontinents at the time, moved into the polar region. This set off a huge drop in temperature, also a huge increase in glacial formation, which dropped sea levels. Marine invertebrates were the hardest hit. Two-thirds of all the brachiopod and bryozoan families disappeared. It was also a tough time to be a bivalve or a trilobite. And just because I find this fascinating, there's also another theory about what may have happened to cause the Ordovician event. A gamma ray burst from a hypernova somewhere within 6,000 light years of Earth. A supernova, that's when a star explodes. A hypernova is when a star that's like 100 to 300 times the size of the sun explodes. Even like 10 seconds of a gamma ray burst from a hypernova would completely destroy the ozone layer and dose everything on Earth with a nice, healthy amount of UV radiation. When I say healthy, I mean unhealthy. All right, everybody, back in the time machine. We're going ahead 100 million years to 360 million years ago to the late Devonian extinctions. This is the beginning of a prolonged series of mass extinctions in which half of all genera and 70% of all species will go bye-bye. Marine life will once again be hit very hard, but so will the spiders and the scorpions and the proto-amphibians, which are just taking their first steps out onto land. Narrowing down a time frame for this event has been difficult. Scientists can only say that over a period of 500,000 to 25 million years, that's a big gap there, I know, there were a series of extinction pulses, each lasting about 100,000 years. No gamma ray bursts are suspected here. This is once again being caused by a global drop-off in temperatures. People aren't sure what caused it. Probably either an asteroid impact or a giant supervolcano. Each of those things would have released massive amounts of dust or ash into the atmosphere, drastically changing the climate. Glaciers probably once again inundated Gondwana. What we also know is that ocean levels fell and lost most of their oxygen in the process, in what's called ocean anoxia. Some believe that temperatures in the steaming seas of the Devonian fell from 93 to about 78 degrees. Coral reefs were hit so hard that it would be 100 million years before they recovered. But there's another interesting theory here, and that's that plants, which were for the first time really taking hold on land, were absorbing so much carbon dioxide from the atmosphere that they actually caused global cooling. So in fact, plants were responsible for that mass extinction event.
How could you?
And now we will travel to the big one, also known as the Permian-Triassic extinction event, also known as the Great Dying. It is now about 250 million years ago, and a combination of catastrophic events is about to totally alter life on planet Earth. So destructive is this event that it remains the only known mass extinction of insects. This may have been triggered by a comet or asteroid impact, but what scientists feel fairly certain about is that a subsequent volcanic eruption in an area known as the Siberian Traps was responsible for an increase in global temperatures of 5 to 10 degrees. These volcanic eruptions covered an area roughly the size of Western Europe, and they lasted for a million years. But then it got worse. The sudden release of gases from methane hydrate reservoirs below the seafloor, possibly caused by underwater volcanic activity, decimated the seas, leading to periods of too much oxygen, called hyperoxia, and too little oxygen, the return of anoxia. And marine life does not fare well in either of these conditions. These two events, at least, possibly others, led to a shift in ocean currents and general inhospitable environment for most of the Earth's species. When the die-off was finally finished, 53% of marine families, 84% of marine genera, 70% of land species, and 95% of marine species were extinct. The Permian extinction had an enormous evolutionary effect, taking place just as mammal-like reptiles like pelycosaurs and therapsids were in their prime. It would be more than 30 million years before these vertebrates and the Earth in general would recover. But it did recover, until 200 million years ago, when the Triassic-Jurassic extinction killed off many early land animals. This includes the death of most of the therapsids, large amphibians, and the archosaurs, paving the way for the age of the dinosaurs. Scientists probably know less about this mass extinction event than any other, but what is known is that 23% of families and 48% of genera went extinct, but what was left fairly untouched were plants and dinosaurs, which now had a lot less competition. This was roughly the time when the massive supercontinent known as Pangaea was breaking apart due to volcanic eruptions. And the massive release of carbon dioxide from those eruptions may have caused some pretty intense global warming. Again, species don't fare well when temperatures increase quickly like this. And it wouldn't be an extinction event without scientists wondering about whether or not there was a massive impact of some kind. But so far, nobody's found any likely crater candidates. But you know where there is evidence of an impact crater? Right off the coast of Mexico's Yucatan Peninsula, and you've heard of this one. It's where a giant asteroid or comet struck about 65 million years ago, and that kicked off the Cretaceous Tertiary extinction. You know this one. It's the one that killed off all the non-avian dinosaurs and ushered in the glorious age of mammals and birds. Mammals and birds! The KT extinction, as it's also known, killed off half of all genera and 75% of species. And while the giant asteroid impact winter theory is the leading one, it's by no means the only one. Also happening at the same time, there was a giant volcanic eruption in India that may have caused massive global warming. And that final extinction event brings us back around to today, where 99% of the species that have ever existed on this planet are extinct. But we aren't. We are the 1%. Now, lucky for us in the history of humanity, we haven't had to deal with any giant comet strikes or super volcanoes, but we do have to deal with a possibly equally destructive force, each other. Some scientists think that we are already in the middle of an event that's moving faster than the KT extinction. But instead of being driven by continents or volcanic eruptions, these extinctions are being caused by rising CO2 levels, habitat destruction, invasive species pollution, and over-harvesting. We already know what changes in global temperature can do to a planet. Click over here for information on that in our climate change video. A normal extinction rate for our planet is about 10 to 25 species per year, and we're already doing about 100 times that. So clearly, 7 billion of us here on this planet are having a pretty big impact. I guess the question that remains for us to answer is, what are we going to call this sixth mass extinction event?
On that chipper note, let's pause for a break.
Conservation is the first and best resource option for BC. Do your part. Turn off the lights when you leave a room and unplug your cell phone charger when charging is complete. Visit bchydro.com to find out more ways you can make a difference. This message brought to you by BC Hydro Power Smart and CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver.
You're listening to Radio Freethinker, the brand name drug of choice for skeptics everywhere. And we're back. Okay, extinction is bad, but what if they developed a pill to cure extinction? And actually, on that note, how exactly are drugs created and come to market? Let's listen into Healthcare Triage explain how it works south of the border, which is basically the same here. Let's listen in.
Have you ever taken an over-the-counter medication for heartburn? How about an antibiotic for an ear infection? At some point, pretty much all of us have visited a pharmacy to pick up a drug, but we likely don't consider where those drugs come from or how they're made. Whether you're talking about something for seasonal allergies or your grandparents' arthritis medication, the act of bringing a drug to market is long and complex. I'm not an expert, but Healthcare Triage intern Rachel Hoffman is, and with her help, that's the topic of this week's Healthcare Triage. Before you start making a drug, you need to make sure that there's a target for that drug. Drug targets can include things like cancer cells, viruses, enzymes, or receptors on the surface of our own cells. For example, drugs like morphine and hydrocodone interact with opioid receptors in the brain to decrease pain perception. Once a target has been identified, researchers can begin developing a new drug. New drugs can be discovered in any number of ways. Many of the drugs we use today are derived from natural products. Pyrethrin, a natural pesticide found in some lice shampoos, comes from the chrysanthemum flower. And exenatide, a drug used in treating type 2 diabetes, is the synthetic derivative of a substance found in Gila monster saliva. Drugs can also be developed in the lab to have specific chemical structures to fit a given target, similar to how a locksmith would design a key to fit a lock. This is called de novo drug design, meaning that the drug molecule is a new structure never before seen in nature. The most common way new drugs are discovered today is by a process known as high throughput screening, or HTS. HTS utilizes robotics and high-speed computers to evaluate huge numbers of potential drug molecules quickly and efficiently. If a compound is found to be active for a given target, it may be considered for further investigation. Using any of these methods, an estimated 5,000 to 10,000 molecules may be identified for potential use at an established drug target. Once identified, potential drug compounds undergo rigorous preclinical studies. Researchers will use living cells, animals, and computer models to assess things like how a compound is absorbed, where it distributes throughout the body, how and where it's metabolized, and how the potential drug compound is excreted from the body. The study of drug absorption, distribution, metabolism, and excretion is known as pharmacokinetics, a fancy schmancy word that describes what the body does to a drug. And again, these tests are extensive. In the United States, the Food and Drug Administration, or FDA, requires that such studies be done for every compound before they can be tested in humans. These studies are critical for estimating safety and an appropriate starting dose for human trials. A large percentage of potential compounds are eliminated before and during this stage of drug development. The 5,000 to 10,000 compounds they may have started with will likely be reduced to 5 or fewer candidate drugs. Before a drug can be tested in humans in the United States, an investigational new drug, or IND application, must be filed with the FDA. This application includes a comprehensive report on all the data on animal studies, the chemical compositions of the drug's pharmacokinetic information and side effect profile, and a detailed account of the study design of the forthcoming clinical trials. The FDA carefully reviews these applications before allowing trials to proceed, and it has the authority to halt trials at any time. This type of process in general varies from country to country. The European Medicines Agency, the PDMA of Japan, and Health Canada all have their own regulations and procedures regarding drug trials. Once allowed to proceed, clinical trials progress in three phases. In phase one trials, researchers establish the safety of a drug by evaluating the pharmacokinetic profile and documenting any and all side effects. Dose escalation may also occur to establish the highest tolerated dose of the compound. Phase 1 trials usually involve roughly 20 to 100 healthy volunteers. An exception to this are trials investigating cancer drugs, in which seriously ill patients who are not responding to standard therapy are the study population. In phase 2, the candidate drug is tested to establish safety and efficacy of the compound. Such tests are usually done in about 100 to 600 volunteers with the disease state under investigation. Pharmacokinetics and side effects are still monitored, but researchers are primarily interested in understanding if the drug has the effect we want on disease and its symptoms. Phase 2 inquiries also focus on finding the optimal dose for sick patients. Phase 3 is very similar to phase 2 in that its purpose is to establish safety and efficacy, but it's done on a much larger scale. Thousands of volunteers with the disease state from all over the world are involved in these trials. The larger numbers allow researchers to present statistically significant data to the FDA about the drug's safety and efficacy. Information from phase 3 is also key in establishing the labeling data that will accompany the final drug product. You know those thin folded sheets of paper that come with your prescriptions that look like a Dickens novel printed in two-point type? All of that stuff was figured out and finalized in phase 3 clinical trials. Okay, so after all this, should all go well, it's time to reassess. The drug is safe. The drug is effective. Now we have a new drug ready to be prescribed, right? No. Everything needs to be approved by a nation's regulatory body once again before the drug can be marketed. Throughout all the phases of clinical trials, investigators are constantly analyzing their data and compiling information for submission to regulatory bodies. In the United States, at this point, a new drug application, or NDA, must be submitted to the FDA. The FDA then reviews the data and decides whether or not to approve the drug. Submission of an NDA does not guarantee approval. The FDA may issue an approvable letter to the investigators requiring additional studies, or they may deny approval of the drug altogether. But let's say the drug is approved. Then what? Well, naturally, the drug's gonna work perfectly. Nobody experiences any nausea or has dizziness when standing. We all live forever, and Ned Stark turns out not to be dead after all, right? Guys? No? Of course not. Even though a drug may have been studied over decades and thousands of volunteers, it's impossible to know exactly how this drug will affect every single patient. That's why there's a fourth phase of drug research known as post-market surveillance. In post-market surveillance, drugs are continually monitored, and pharmaceutical companies often submit long-term safety data to the FDA. Consumers and practitioners can also participate in phase 4 by reporting adverse drug events to the FDA's MedWatch program. So, to recap, the drug development process is complicated. You find a target, test for a compound to hit it, do preclinical studies, get approval for human trials, complete phase 1, phase 2, and phase 3, then get approval again, and finally monitor the drug's use until forever to make sure it's still safe and working. This whole process of bringing a drug to market takes a really long time. From a drug's discovery to the point where you can finally find it in the pharmacy takes an average of 15 years, according to industry. Let's put that into perspective. 15 years ago, Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire was new on the shelves, the PS2 had just come out, and the only Marvel movie in theaters was X-Men, the original X-Men. Even then, we sometimes screw up. Some people claim it's too easy to get a drug approved. Others claim it's too hard. Debate should continue, and it will.
Now, there's been a lot of debate between which is better, brand name drugs or generic. Let's listen into our final installment from Healthcare Triage on how they differ and how they're really the same.
We've already discussed generic and brand drug names, but are there differences beyond the words? That's the topic of this week's Healthcare Triage. Let's start with a story. When a drug first comes to market in the United States, its parent company can sell it exclusively under a brand name for a certain number of years. This length of time depends how many years are left on the drug's patent and the type of exclusivity granted at the time of approval by the FDA. When the patent or exclusivity runs out, other manufacturers can begin making a generic. The generic product is sometimes cheaper than the brand name version. This is probably why some generic products get a bad rap. There's this pervasive misperception that generic things are generally not as good as the brand because they're cheaper. While this may be true about those weird store brand Fruit Loops with no bird on the box, the same logic can't really be applied to generic drugs. Here's why. Before a company can manufacture and market a generic drug in the United States, it must submit an abbreviated new drug application, or ANDA, to the FDA. This application includes data providing the generic product is both pharmaceutically equivalent and bioequivalent to the branded product. Pharmaceutical equivalence means that the generic drug contains the same drug compound as the innovator drug, as well as having the same strength, same route of administration, and same dosage form. To achieve bioequivalence, the generic product must have the same effect as the brand drug, meaning that the compound has the same action in the body in the same amount of time. But make no mistake, just because the brand and generic have identical drug molecules and are bioequivalent and pharmaceutically equivalent does not mean that they are the same in every way. That's because of excipients. Excipients are the inactive ingredients in a drug product, or the stuff that's not the active drug molecule. Let's say you took a 10 milligram tablet of a popular allergy medication. If you weigh the tablet on a scale, it will definitely be heavier than 10 milligrams. That's because 10 milligrams is really tiny. It would be nearly impossible to make a drug tablet so small, let alone expect someone to take it. For example, a quarter teaspoon of table salt weighs like 1,500 milligrams. 10 milligrams is like less than 10 grains of kosher salt. Some drugs use less than a milligram of active ingredient even. Therefore, drug manufacturers will use approved compounds like lactose, starch, and microcrystalline cellulose as dilutants to bulk up tablets. Other excipients might help tablets disintegrate in the digestive tract or provide flavoring and coloring. The list goes on and can get a little overwhelming when you start including dosage forms like inhalers, patches, creams, and ointments. Generic and brand drugs will always have the same active ingredients, but their excipients may vary. One or the other may have slightly more or fewer types of inactive ingredients depending on their manufacturing processes. Coloring agents usually also differ, so products can distinguish themselves. But remember, even though the entire ingredient list may not be exactly the same between brand and generic, the generic manufacturer must still prove to the FDA that their product is entirely bioequivalent. If not, then an adjustment to the excipients may be warranted. In the late 1960s, an outbreak of intoxication occurred in Australia among patients taking the anticonvulsant drug phenytoin. In 87% of patients experiencing toxicity, drug levels measured in the blood were well beyond the therapeutic range, putting them at risk of side effects. Many patients had changes in gait, and some even experienced vomiting, double vision, and other abnormalities in mental function. The good news is that the majority of people returned to normal once their dose was lowered. But why were patients that had been stable on their anticonvulsant medication all of a sudden experiencing toxicity? You guessed it, excipients. After evaluating the phenytoin capsules, investigators discovered that in 1967, one manufacturer had changed its dilutant, or bulking agent, from calcium disulfate dehydrate to lactose. The lactose formulation allowed the phenytoin to dissolve more readily from the capsule, leading to higher concentrations in the blood. Thus, some patients began to experience toxic side effects, while others that were previously getting little benefit from the phenytoin had their seizures under control for the first time. This incident shows that excipients aren't inert and justifies why it's so critical that brand and generic drugs be both pharmaceutically and bioequivalent. Today, the FDA and other regulatory bodies around the globe are really strict about all this. They aren't approving generic forms of drugs willy-nilly. In addition to being pharmaceutically equivalent and bioequivalent, generic drugs must have the same strength, identity, purity, and quality as the branded product. So the FDA regulates things. No surprises there. But why should we take their word for it? To the research. A 2008 meta-analysis published in JAMA compared the clinical effectiveness of generic and brand-name cardiovascular drugs. The study included 38 randomized controlled trials of 9 different subclasses of these medications. Bioequivalence was seen in all studies of beta blockers, antiplatelet agents, statins, ACE inhibitors, alpha blockers, antiarrhythmic agents, and warfarin. It was seen in 10 of 11 randomized controlled trials of diuretics and 71% of calcium channel blockers. So not perfect, but these differences were minor and did not impact clinical outcomes. Overall, the aggregate effect of the meta-analysis indicated that there were no significant differences between brand and generic drugs. The same study also examined editorials and commentaries discussing the interchangeability of brand and generic cardiovascular drugs. Of 43 editorials, more than half expressed a negative view of generic drugs. Let's look deeper. Some drugs have what's known as a narrow therapeutic index, meaning that the drug is only effective within a very small dosage range. Too little and the drug will have no effect, too much and the drug can cause harm. One such drug is the blood thinner Coumadin, also known by its generic name warfarin. Not everyone responds to warfarin in the same way, so those taking it have their blood monitored regularly so that appropriate dose adjustments can be made. Because of this, physicians and pharmacists are hesitant to interchange the brand and generic versions of Coumadin and drugs like it. But what did the data say? A review article published in 2011 in the Journal of Pharmacotherapy examined 5 randomized controlled trials and 6 observational studies comparing outcomes when switching patients from Coumadin to generic warfarin. The observational study suggested that those switching between brand and generic should be monitored more closely. So perhaps there's a reason to be more cautious about switching between brand and generic warfarin. In the randomized controlled trials, though, there were no significant differences reported at all. No studies showed that the branded drugs were more effective than the generic. Similar results were seen in systematic reviews of anti-epileptic drugs. Even though national regulatory bodies require a mountain of data proving bioequivalence and independent studies have shown that generics are just as effective as innovator drugs, there's still this lingering perception among some practitioners that generic drugs aren't as good. A survey of 506 physicians in the United States revealed that as many as 23% had negative opinions on the efficacy of generic drugs, and those over the age of 55 were more than 3 times as likely to believe that. Another survey looked at both physicians and pharmacists. While 11.8% of doctors believed that generic drugs were less effective than the brand product, only 2.3% of pharmacists shared this opinion. Why? Here's what Rachel thought.
Pharmacists spend a lot of time in school learning about the chemical nature of drugs and how excipients work in drug products, perhaps resulting in a higher degree of confidence in a well-formulated generic. Conversely, physicians may be more likely to hear firsthand accounts of patients being unhappy with a generic, making them less likely to prescribe it in the future.
Ignoring this has consequences. A 2014 study compared adherence to statin therapies in patients that were started on either the brand or generic drug. A significantly higher number of patients started on generics were compliant with their medication regimen, and those taking generics had an 8% reduction in hospitalization for acute coronary syndrome or stroke. Why? Because generics cost less, and people are more likely to stick to stuff that's not as expensive for them. This matters. A chemical compound is a chemical compound. And as long as bioequivalence is assured, brand and generic drugs should give the same results. there may be good reason to be cautious when switching back and forth between different formulations of certain narrow therapeutic index drugs, but for the vast majority of small molecular drugs, there's no difference. Don't get hung up on the labels.
I think it's time for us to take a pill and take a break.
Join Team PowerSmart. Set an energy conservation target of 10%. You'll get access to tools to help you conserve, and you can track your progress online. Visit bchydro.com/Team PowerSmart to join today. This message brought to you by BC Hydro PowerSmart and CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver.
Listening to Radio Freethinker, the power law of skeptic radio shows. And we're back. Okay, we think language, literature, is art. That it's, at base, follows no law or predictability. Well, as we listen to Vsauce, we will discover that that's not true. And an American linguist named George Kinsley Zipf discovered this over 80 years ago. Let's listen in as we discover the power law behind Zipf's law.
Hey, Vsauce, Michael here. About 6% of everything you say and read and write is the is the most used word in the English language. About 1 out of every 16 words we encounter on a daily basis is the. The top 20 most common English words in order are the of and to. A-N is I, that it for you was with on, as have, but be they. That's a fun fact, a piece of trivia, but it's also more. You see, whether the most commonly used words are ranked across an entire language, or in just one book or article, almost every time a bizarre pattern emerges. The second most used word will appear about half as often as the most used. The third, one-third as often. The fourth, one-fourth as often. The fifth, one-fifth as often. The sixth, one-sixth as often. And so on, all the way down. Seriously. For some reason, the amount of times a word is used is just proportional to 1 over its rank. Word frequency and ranking on a log-log graph follow a nice straight line, a power law. This phenomenon is called Zipf's Law. And it doesn't only apply to English. It also applies to other languages, like, well, all of them. Even ancient languages we haven't been able to translate yet. And here's the thing, we have no idea why. It's surprising that something as complex as reality should be conveyed by something as creative as language in such a predictable way. How predictable? Well, watch this. According to wordcount.org, which ranks words as found in the British National Corpus, sauce is the 5,555th most common English word. Now, here is a list of how many times every word on Wikipedia and in the entire Gutenberg corpus of tens of thousands of public domain books shows up. The most used word, the, shows up about 181 million times. Knowing these two things, we can estimate that the word sauce should appear about 30,000 times on Wikipedia and Gutenberg combined. And it pretty much does. What gives? The world is chaotic. Things are distributed in myriads of ways, not just power laws, and language is personal, intentional, idiosyncratic. What about the world and ourselves could cause such complex activities and behaviors to follow such a basic rule? We literally don't know. More than a century of research has yet to close the case. Moreover, Zipf's law doesn't just mysteriously describe word use. It's also found in city populations, solar flare intensities, protein sequences and immune receptors, the amount of traffic websites get, earthquake magnitudes, the number of times academic papers are cited, last names, the firing patterns of neural networks, ingredients used in cookbooks, the number of phone calls people receive, the diameter of moon craters, the number of people that die in wars, the popularity of opening chess moves, even the rate at which we forget. There are plenty of theories about why language is ziffy, but no firm conclusions. And this video doesn't contain a definite explanation either. Sorry, I know that's a bummer since we appear to like knowing more than mystery. But that said, we also ask more than we answer. So let's dive into ZIF's ramifications, some related patterns, some possible explanations, and the depth of the mystery itself. ZIF's law was popularized by George Ziff, a linguist at Harvard University. It is a discrete form of the continuous Pareto distribution, from which we get the Pareto principle. Because so many real-world processes behave this way, the Pareto principle tells us that, as a rule of thumb, it's worth assuming that 20% of the causes are responsible for 80% of the outcome. Like in language, where the most frequently used 18% of words account for over 80% of word occurrences. In 1896, Vilfredo Pareto showed that approximately 80% of the land in Italy was owned by just 20% of the population. It is said that he later noticed in his garden, 20% of his pea pods contained 80% of the peas. He and other researchers looked at other data sets and found that this 80-20 imbalance comes up a lot in the world. The richest 20% of humans have 82.7% of the world's income. In the US, 20% of patients use 80% of healthcare resources. In 2002, Microsoft reported that 80% of the errors and crashes in Windows and Office are caused by 20% of the bugs detected. A common rule of thumb in the business world states that 20% of your customers are responsible for 80% of your profits, and 80% of the complaints you receive will come from 20% of your customers. A book titled The 80-20 Principle even says that in a home or office, 20% of the carpet receives 80% of the wear. Oh, and as Woody Allen famously said, 80% of success is just showing up. The Pareto principle is everywhere, which is good. By focusing on just 20% of what's wrong, you can often expect to solve 80% of the problems. A variety of different unrelated factors cause this to be true from case to case. But if we can get to the bottom of what causes some of them, maybe we'll find that one or more of those mechanisms is responsible for Ziff's law in language. George Ziff himself thought language's interesting rank frequency distribution was a consequence of the principle of least effort, the tendency for life and things to follow the path of least resistance. Ziff believed it drove much of human behavior and hypothesized that as language developed in our species, speakers naturally preferred drawing from as few words as possible to get their thoughts out there. It was easier. But in order to understand what was being said, listeners preferred larger vocabularies that gave more specificity so that they had to do less work. The compromise between listening and speaking, Ziff felt, led to the current state of language. A few words are used often, and many, many, many words are used rarely. Recent papers have suggested that having a few short, often used, predictable words helps dissipate information load density on listeners, spacing out important vocab so that the information rate is more constant. This makes sense, and much has been learned by applying the least effort principle to other behaviors, but later researchers argued that for language, the explanation was even more simple. Just a few years after Ziff's seminal paper, Benoit Mandelbrot showed that there may be nothing mysterious about Ziff's law at all. because even if you just randomly type on a keyboard, you will produce words distributed according to Zipf's law. It's a pretty cool point, and this is why it happens. There are exponentially more different long words than short words. For instance, the English alphabet can be used to make 26 one-letter words, but 26 squared two-letter words. Also, in random typing, whenever the space bar is pressed, a word terminates. Since there's always a certain chance that the space bar will be pressed, longer stretches of time before it happens are exponentially less likely than shorter ones. The combination of these exponentials is pretty ziffy. For example, if all 26 letters and the space bar are equally likely to be typed, after a letter is typed and a word has begun, the probability that the next input will be a space, thus creating a one-letter word, is just 1 in 27. And sure enough, if you randomly generate characters or hire a proverbial typing monkey, about 1 out of every 27, or 3.7% of the stuff between spaces, will be single letters. Two-letter words appear when, after beginning a word, any character but the space bar is hit, a 26 in 27 chance, and then the space bar. A three-letter word is the probability of a letter, another letter, and then a space. If we divide by the number of unique words of each length there can be, we get the frequency of occurrence expected for any particular word given its length. For example, the letter V will make up about 0.142% of random typing. The word Vsauce, 0.00000000993%. Longer words are less likely, but watch this. Let's spread these frequencies out according to the ranks they'd take up on a most often used list. There are 26 possible one-letter words, so each of the top 26 ranked words are expected to occur about this often. The next 676 ranks will be taken up by two-letter words that show up about this often. If we extend each frequency according to how many members it has, we get Zipf. Subsequent researchers have detailed how changing up the initial conditions can smooth the steps out. Our mysterious distribution has been created out of nothing but the inevitabilities of math. So, maybe there is no mystery. Maybe words are just the result of humans randomly segmenting the observable world and the mental world into labels. And Zipf's law describes what naturally happens when you do that. Case closed. And as always, thanks for wait a minute. Actual language is very different from random typing. Communication is deterministic to a certain extent. Utterances and topics arrive based on what was said before. And the vocabulary we have to work with certainly isn't the result of purely random naming. For example, the monkey typing model can't explain why even the names of the elements, the planets, and the days of the week are used in language according to Zipf's law. Sets like these are constrained by the natural world, and they're not the result of us randomly segmenting the world into labels. Furthermore, when given a list of novel words, words they've never heard or used before, like when prompted to write a story about alien creatures with strange names, people will naturally tend to use the name of one alien twice as often as another, three times as often as another. Zipf's law appears to be built into our brains. Perhaps there is something about the way thoughts and topics of discussion ebb and flow that contributes to Zipf's law. Another way Zipfian distributions occur is via processes that change according to how they've previously operated. These are called preferential attachment processes. They occur when something, money, views, attention, variation, friends, jobs, anything really, is given out according to how much is already possessed. To go back to the carpet example, if most people walk from the living room to the kitchen across a certain path, furniture will be placed elsewhere, making that path even more popular. The more views a video or image or post has, the more likely it is to get recommended automatically or make the news for having so many views, both of which give it more views. It's like a snowball rolling down a snowy hill. The more snow it accumulates, the bigger its surface area becomes for collecting more, and the faster it grows. There doesn't have to be a deliberate choice driving a preferential attachment process. It can happen naturally. Try this. Take a bunch of paper clips and grab any two at random, link them together, and then throw them back in the pile. Now, repeat over and over again. If you grab paper clips that are already part of a chain, link them anyway. More often than not, after a while, you will have a distribution that looks Ziffian. A small number of chains contain a disproportionate amount of the total paperclip count. This is simply because the longer a chain gets, the greater proportion of the whole it contains, which gives it a better chance of being picked up in the future and consequently made even longer. The rich get richer, the big get bigger, the popular get popularer. It's just math. Perhaps language's Ziff mystery is, if not caused by, at least strengthened by, preferential attachment. Once a word is used, it's more likely to be used again soon. Critical points may play a role as well. Writing and conversation often stick to a topic until a critical point is reached and the subject is changed and the vocabulary shifts. Processes like these are known to result in power laws. So, in the end, it seems tenable that all these mechanisms might collude to make Ziff's law the most natural way for language to be. Perhaps some of our vocabulary and grammar was developed randomly, according to Mandelbrot's theory, and the natural way conversation and discussion follow preferential attachment and criticality, coupled with the principle of least effort when speaking and listening, are all responsible for the relationship between word rank and frequency. It's a shame that the answer isn't simpler, but it's fascinating because of the consequences it has on what communication is made of. Roughly speaking, and this is mind-blowing, nearly half of any book, conversation, or article will be nothing but the same 50 to 100 words, and nearly the other half will be words that appear in that selection only once. That's not so surprising when you consider the fact that one word accounts for 6% of what we say. The top 25 most used words make up about a third of everything we say, and the top 100? About half. Seriously, I mean, whether it's all the words in Wet Hot American Summer, or all the words in Plato's Complete Works, or in the Complete Works of Edgar Allan Poe, or the Bible itself, only about 100 words are used for nearly half of everything written or said. In Alice's Adventures in Wonderland, 44%, and in Tom Sawyer, 49.8% of the unique words used appear only once in the book. A word that is used only once in a given selection of words is called a hapax legomenon. Hapax legomena are vitally important to understanding languages. If a word has only been found once in the entire known collection of an ancient language, it can be very difficult to figure out what it means. Now, there is no corpus of everything ever said or written in English, but there are very, very large collections, and it's fun to find hapax legomena in them. For instance, and this probably won't be the case after I mention it, but the word quizzaciously is in the Oxford English Dictionary, but appears nowhere on Wikipedia, or in the Gutenberg corpus, or in the British National Corpus, or the American National Corpus, but it does appear, when searched, in just one result on Google. Fittingly, in a book titled Elder Speak that lists it as a rare word. Quizzaciously, by the way, means in a mocking manner, as in, the parodist rattled off quizzaciously, "Hey, Vsauce, Michael here, but who is Michael, and how much does here weigh?" It's a little sad, that quizzaciously has been used so infrequently. It's a fun word, but that's the way things go in a Ziffian system. Some things get all the love, some get little. Most of what you experience on a day-to-day basis is forgotten, forgettable. The Dictionary of Obscure Sorrows, as it often does, has a word for this, olika, the awareness of how few days are memorable. I've been alive for almost 11,000 days, but I couldn't tell you something about each one of them. I mean, not even close. Most of what we do and see and think and say and hear and feel is forgotten at a rate quite similar to Zipf's law. Which makes sense. If a number of factors naturally selected for thinking and talking about the world with tools in a Zipfian way, it makes sense we'd remember it that way too. Some things really well. Most things hardly at all. But it bums me out sometimes because it means that so much is forgotten. Even things that at the time you thought you could never forget. My locker number, senior year. Its combination. The jokes I liked when I saw a comedian on stage. The names of people I saw every day 10 years ago. So many memories are gone. When I look at all the books I've read and realize that I can't remember every detail from them, it's a little disappointing. I mean, why even bother if the Pareto Principle dictates that my Ziffian mind will consciously remember pretty much only the titles and a few basic reactions years later? Ralph Waldo Emerson makes me feel better. He once said, "I cannot remember the books I've read any more than the meals I have eaten. Even so, they have made me."
And that's all the time we have this week. This is Don saying, eyes open, mind's on.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rose. A morning filled with 400 million suns.
To the main church, and it comes with me.